Well, the Bible is filled with many hopeless and impossible situations, isn't it? I mean, just read it. I mean, it's better than any novel that you would read. I mean, you can't make the stuff up that you read about in the Bible. I mean, truth is far better than fiction. But a lot of times there's these circumstances and situations that appear from a human point of view impossible to overcome. And in this chapter, Jesus is going to encounter a new set of impossible situations. He's going to encounter this man that's possessed by thousands of demons, legion. And we see that account. And the demon-possessed man is in a desperate condition. I mean, he's unable to help himself. Those around him are not able to help him. But he goes to Jesus, and Jesus is able to help him. And next, Jesus is going to encounter a diseased woman and a dead girl. And all of these situations are hopeless from a human perspective. But Jesus is going to prove that he is the master of the hopeless and impossible events that take place in our life. Now, Pastor Chris actually taught the first part of this chapter, April 17th, 2013. I encourage you to check it out online. It's free. He titled it Dead, Delivered, and Deployed, about God's redemptive power. And so if you want to get to know Chris a little bit better, he shared his testimony there. Listen to the message. I will warn you that he cried a lot, and that might shock you because he never does that, but listen to it. Now, I love that about Chris because, you know, he would tell you that he was very hard before he came to know the Lord, and I love that the Lord takes a heart of stone and he turns it into a heart of flesh. So let's read Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 43, and then we'll go back and take a closer look at each verse. So Mark chapter 5 started in verse 21. Now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little girl lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her, that she may be healed, and she will live." So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, for she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." Immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." While he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him. But when he had put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kumai," which is translated, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement. But he commanded them strictly that no one should know it, and said that something should be given her to eat. And so in verse 21, we'll go back and look at kind of each verse here. Now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him. It's funny when you're doing Bible study and you're like, okay, I want to get to kind of the crescendo of the message. Let's get to kind of the meatier verses. And God says, "No, I want you to stop, Joey. There's something that I have for you, and there's something that I have for your people." Because it's interesting, when you look at the original language, the word, when it says gather to him, the Greek word is epi. and it means after him. After him means in pursuit of. And I felt like the Lord was saying, are we in pursuit of him today like the multitude was in pursuit of him back then? It's a question that we need to ask ourselves. And it says, he was by the sea. It means he was by the shoreline. So he literally just pulled up in the boat and when this is taking place. And so Jesus had crossed over. Remember that Jesus had left the Gentile region around the Sea of Galilee. And then that's where he met and he healed the man possessed by thousands of demons. I kind of picture that guy, you know, because it says he's strong and he breaks out of like every chain that they try to put him in. Nobody can contain him. But for me, you know, for you Lord of the Ring fans, I kind of picture Smeagol, Gollum, and Sloth from the Goonies combined. Now, I know that Goonies was like in 1985, but it was like, you know, I was like 15 or whatever, right? But you know what's funny about those movies, like your childhood movies, is like, you're like, dude, this was like the movie. I mean, this is like one of my favorite movies. And then you're like, let's watch it with the kids. And you start watching it, and you don't remember that that was in there, and that was, okay, kids, let's turn that off. Like, hey, I don't remember those parts. But, you know, it just reminds me, you know, Sloth, Gollum and Smeagol all rolled into one. And then he gets back in the boat and he sails across to the Jewish side of the Sea of Galilee and he pulls up in the boat, probably near the Capernaum shoreline. Capernaum was kind of the headquarters of Jesus. And there's these large crowds that are waiting for him. And remember, Jesus probably hasn't even gotten out of the boat yet. Yet, he is the center of their attention. Is he the center of our attention today? You know, I think he's earned the right to have that. And in verse 22, it says, and behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name. So you have to understand who this guy is first before we kind of, it plays out in the story. But each synagogue had 10 rulers. They were called elders. And one would be chosen to be the ruler of the synagogue. So if he had a business card today and he handed it to you, it would say president or CEO of the synagogue. Okay, so he was basically an important man. He was the guy that oversaw both the spiritual and the business affairs of the synagogue. So think of him like a pastor or an assistant pastor. So he was very influential. He was a respected man. He was powerful. He was wealthy, and he was successful. So he was a very important man in this community. So pretty much when Jairus spoke, people listened. When he walked into a room, people stood up in recognition. I want you guys to think of him as a man who had everything. And most men in this position would have aligned themselves with the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the day. Now you have to understand when this is happening that Jesus is a wanted man, not only by the multitudes that followed him everywhere he went, but also by the religious leaders of the day that sought to destroy him. We see earlier on in the chapter that Jesus tells these guys, they're very much focused on the Sabbath and the law and that type of thing. And he says, hey, the Sabbath wasn't made for man, but man for the Sabbath. And so they don't like this and they plot to kill him. They plot to destroy him. So he was both famous with the people, but he was infamous with the religious leaders of the day. And that's important for you to understand because what happens next is a huge risk to his career. Now, Jairus, his name in Hebrew, it means whom Jehovah enlightens. And so there's something that he's going to be enlightened. And this is what enlightened means. It means to give intellectual or spiritual light to instruct or to impart knowledge to. Now, he knew about Jesus. Maybe he heard about him earlier on in the chapter when the withered man, his hand was touched and healed by Jesus. That happened in Capernaum. Capernaum is where the synagogue is at, where Jairus is the leader over. I don't know for certain, but what I do know, what we can see from the text, what we know for sure is that Jairus knew who to ask for help when trouble came. In church, so do we. We know who to reach out to ask for help as well. Psalm 46:1 tells us that God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. So when you need help, you can call out to God and he'll help you. And it says, and when he, Jairus, saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. That doesn't sound like something this type of man would do. He's a proud man, right? He's a respected man, but he had good reason to fall before Jesus. Look at verse 23. And it said, and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death." We know from Luke's account that it tells us not only is this his daughter, but it's his only daughter. And she's 12 years old and she's dying. Death is knocking at the door. So you have to picture that. She's at least 12 years old. So that's 4,380 days of memories for this dad. And parents, you know, memories are special to us, aren't they? You know, I have a 20-year-old and almost an 18-year-old, and I remember the day we brought our son home, our firstborn son, from the doctor. I remember telling Shalynn, like, did they give you a manual with this thing? Like, do you know what you're doing? I have no clue what we're supposed to do here, right? You know, we have all these memories, you know, kindergartens, first bike ride, you know, all of these things that as parents are special to us. What was Jairus thinking about when he heard that his little daughter was at the point of death? What memories are flashing in the forefront of his minds? Also, it's interesting to me that she is the only daughter of this couple. Remember, this couple would be considered like a power couple today, very successful, okay? And, you know, in the Jewish culture, they usually had more than one child. So it made me think, I mean, I don't know for certain, but is she a miracle child, kind of like Isaac was? And even that's more even devastating, because not it's just that she's a little girl, an only child, but maybe she's a miracle baby. So add insult to injury to that situation. Now, I've heard that a bond between a father and a daughter is very special. I don't have any daughters of my own, but sometimes I picture what our daughter would have looked like. We, you know, when you have children, it's a boy, we're going to name this. If it's a girl, we're going to name this. So if we would have had a girl, we would have named her Caitlin Marie McKee, and Marie after my wife. So I picture her very much as she has the beauty of my wife, and so I'd have to, like, get a shotgun pretty soon. And she has Shalynn's infectious personality. But I also know that God has a sense of humor. And so you need to know something about my wife. Like, when my wife and I were dating, I played football with my wife. If that tells you any type of person, she's very much a tomboy. So she's very much the mother of boys. And I remember dating her, I'm like, you don't like to shop and you like sports? I mean, where do I sign the paperwork here? I mean, let's just get this thing, let's get rolling here. I mean, you can sign me up today, right? But I picture our little daughter very girly, the complete opposite of my wife, because God has a sense of humor. And so I can pop some popcorn, kick back, and watch them kind of go at it. I can almost hear my wife saying, you know, I mean, you know, just watching them kind of go after it, and her saying, like, you know, get over yourself, drama queen. I mean, you know, I could just picture my wife just doing that. But, you know, I don't have a biological daughter of my own, but you know what I do have? I do have a few adopted daughters running around this place that are special to me, that I've seen grow up. And I know the heart of a father is to instinctively, fathers, you know, to protect your daughter at all costs. And so Jairus has no power to fix his little girl. If he could, he would. And so his position, his power, or his money cannot buy him a solution to that problem. So what does he do? The text tells us that he begged Jesus earnestly. I love that in the Greek, because it means begged here means to call to one's aid. So he called Jesus to his aid greatly. Church, this is what desperation looks like. This is the heart of a father for his only little girl. You see, sickness and death could care less about who this man is, what he possesses, or what his position is. And I picture mom at home as well. While Jairus is seeking Jesus, I picture the mom at home, and maybe she's putting a cold cloth on her little girl's forehead, and she's whispering in her ear, "Everything will be okay, sweetheart." And so Jairus has no power to fix his little girl. Religion cannot help him with this problem. Everything that he's learned religiously to this point, it's worthless to him. But he still has one option. He can ask for help for someone greater than himself. And he does that. He humbles himself in front of this huge crowd, and he asks for that help as he says to Jesus, "Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed and she will live." And this is not the normal word for healed. Healed here means saved, as in the doctor saved her life. Okay, so he's asking Jesus to spare her life. Okay. Now, notice that he has faith here. He knows where to go to for help. There's a faith. There's a demonstration of belief in Jesus that he could save his little girl. And Jesus was Jairus' only hope for that to happen. And in verse 24, it says, so Jesus went with him. It means he went off with Jesus promptly. So he hears his story and he says, yeah, let's go. Now, I think that's important because Mark, in his gospel, he presents Jesus as the ultimate servant. So I want you, as we go through this text, to see all of the things that Jesus does as a servant, okay? Because we're called to be servants as well. The greatest in the kingdom shall be the CEO, right? Oh, no, I think it says the greatest shall be the servant, right? If you want to be great, be servant to all, okay? So he went off with Jairus promptly, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. Okay, what does that mean? It means to press together, press on all sides to the point of suffocation. And so you might see this, let's say you went to like a concert. I hear Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood are in town, right? There's some thronging that's happening there, right? Have you ever been between, well, you, I know you were because it's 10 o'clock service, but the hallways between 10 o'clock and 11:45, there's some thronging that's happening there, right? I mean, we need air traffic controllers just to help you guys get through there. You're like, I just want to get something to eat, right? And it's, you know, it is, you're pushed together. And so that's the idea here is the people around him are suffocating him. The crowd is pressing up against Jesus, and it's hard to move forward. It got me thinking that trials can be that way in our lives too, can't they? Trials, difficult things that we go through. Maybe things that we either bring on ourselves or things that we just are put through, right, for the testing of our faith. They can be difficult and they can press up against us, making it harder for us to move forward. And, you know, good brother James, chapter 1, he gives us some good counsel here, but I know you hate this verse. Sometimes I don't like it myself, but it says, James 1, verses 2 through 4 says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And so Jairus is going through it right now, isn't he? He's going through, his faith is going to be tested, and we're going to see what will happen to it. And in verse 25, it says, now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years. Now, notice that we know who Jairus is. We know what he does. But this is a no-name woman. There's no name that's mentioned here. It just says it's a certain woman. We don't know who she is. Is she young? Is she old? Is she married? Does she have children? We don't know for certain, okay? But what we do know is this woman, when it says she has a flow of blood, it's a horrible physical condition that made her very sick. In Young's literal translation of the Bible, it says that it's an issue of blood. It's a flowing issue, like a spring flow. So this woman has a hemorrhage inside her body, okay? It's a bleeding from some part of her body, probably, you know, the menstrual part. You ladies can thank Eve for that when you get to heaven. I don't think you'll be able to talk to her because she's in a witness protection program in heaven, but if she gets out, you can have a conversation with her. But this literally means that she was hemorrhaging or bleeding from some part of her body, and the word issue means a flowing of blood. So whatever caused this internal hemorrhage is she's a very sick woman with a continual flow of blood. I want you guys to picture, remember the sickest that you've ever been in your life, okay? What are you doing? You are like, God, I just want to die, right? I mean, if you just get me over this, I'll give you my firstborn. You know, I mean, you're like, you're making promises to God you have no intention of keeping. I want you to pretend, like, remember the sickest that you've ever been. And imagine being in that condition for 12 years, 4,380 days at least. This woman is in a bad state of affairs. Now, remember, she's had this issue for 12 years. She also has 4,300 days of memories, but not the kind that you want. And it says that she had suffered many things from many physicians. So picture this. After 12 years, all of the doctors that she's went to see, all of the appointments that she's went to and said, maybe this is the time where I'm finally going to get a breakthrough. She experiences no breakthrough. And she comes to this place where she understands that she's living under a death sentence. She's tried everything. Nothing has worked. And if she doesn't do something soon, she's going to die from this disease. She suffered. And there's many ways that she suffered. She suffered physically. This is a constant blood loss. And so this woman would have been weak, would have been anemic and pale. Because I asked myself, well, this is internal bleeding. How would the people know about it because of what we're going to read later on? Well, because you could see it on her face. You could see it. She's very weak, very pale. I mean, the easiest task for us to do would have completely wiped her out of energy. That's the condition here, okay? So she knows she's living under a death sentence. And then she suffered medically. We're told that she tried all kinds of remedies from the physicians of her day. Now, physicians obviously aren't as skilled as the physicians that we have today, but it's still called practicing medicine, isn't it? Okay? But it was way, way not up to speed back then. I mean, I just look at a couple examples here. Some of the examples of their medical techniques can be found in the Talmud, okay? They'd give her potions, but most of these were like superstitious nonsense stuff. Like somebody coming behind her and yelling from her, "Arise from thy flux," like trying to scare her out of her internal bleeding, you know? Just really kooky stuff. I mean, listen to this one. One remedy even called for the woman to carry an ear of corn taken from the dung of a white donkey. Can you imagine getting the bill for that one? How much did you charge me again for that? Is that covered under Medicare or Obamacare or whatever? It's crazy, right? And so she also suffered emotionally. She had lived her life moving from one rejection to the other. This woman's very isolated, she's lonely, and she's desperate because of how she suffered religiously. See, under the law, in you read Leviticus chapter 15, verses 19 and 25 through 27, this woman would have been considered unclean, okay, for 12 years. Remember that. Anything or anyone that she touched was considered unclean. If she sat on a chair and you sat on it, now you're unclean. So as a result, she couldn't socialize with people in public. She would have defiled them, right? And she couldn't go into the woman's court of the temple because she would have been unclean. So religious people of that day and that time would have sent her a very clear message. You're not welcome here. We don't want you here, okay? And she also suffered financially. The Bible tells us that she spent all that she had, and the doctors and their useless remedies couldn't help her and didn't help her. All they had done was drain her bank account dry, and she was left penniless and poor. So the physicians, they only make her condition worse, but the great physician has power to change her condition. And I hope that you believe that today. And it says in verse 27, when she heard about Jesus, so she didn't know Jesus, but she heard about him. Heard here in the Greek means to learn or become aware of something or someone by hearing. Well, how did she learn or become aware of Jesus? And it gives the sense that she's heard about Jesus for the first time. Someone told her about Jesus. That's how she heard, right? She probably heard it from someone that Jesus had touched in the same manner in which she needed to be touched. Because remember, she's outside of society. She's an outcast. I can tell you who wouldn't have told her about Jesus. The religious leaders of the day and the wealthy of that day and that time. They would have wanted nothing to do with her. And so maybe she heard about Jesus from an outcast just like her, maybe a cripple that Jesus touched and now he was able to walk. Maybe it was from a blind beggar that now could see because of Jesus' touch. By all intents and purposes, an outcast to their society, but to Jesus, not an outcast at all. It just got me thinking. We don't really have a problem telling anybody, recommending a great restaurant or a good movie to see, but we often have a difficult time telling people about Jesus, don't we? And after all of the amazing things that we see that he does here and all the amazing things that he does for us in our life, what good is a movie and a good restaurant in light of eternity, in the light of what Jesus has done for us? And so I just encourage you, God will often give you opportunities to tell people about Jesus and about the work that he's done on the cross. We have to be willing to take those opportunities, amen? Because he can touch and heal just like we see him do to these two folks later on in our story, okay? So he says here, It says she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. Why did she come from behind? Remember, her condition is probably embarrassing since she was ceremonial clean, and she would have been condemned for touching Jesus or even being in that huge crowd. So all she wanted to do was she wanted to come secretly without anyone even noticing her. She just wants to get her miracle and move on. So she would not have openly asked Jesus to heal her, but she kept on saying, so picture that. She's coming from behind the crowd. Every step is draining her of energy. But she has so much faith that if she just touches his clothes, right? It's a type of faith, right? It's a little bit like Jairus's, but if she can just get to him, if she can bob and weave through that crowd and just touch the hem of his garment, she'll be made well. Okay? So she keeps on saying to herself, in the Greek it says she kept on saying, whether it was to herself or to others around her, if only I may touch his garment, I shall be made well. Here's the thinking of the day, and that day and that time. When this unclean woman touched Jesus, it would have made him unclean. But in the economy of God, that's not how that works. See, when she touched his garment, Jesus wasn't made unclean. The woman was made whole. She was saved. And when we come to Jesus with our sin, it doesn't make him a sinner. It makes us whole. Amen? Now, maybe you're here and you're like, well, I don't really see myself as a sinner. I mean, I'm a good person. Well, you may be a good person, but compared to who? Compared to what? You know? I don't really believe in sin. I've had somebody tell me I don't really believe in sin. And I go, can you do me a favor? I want you to do something for me here real quick. I want you to spend about 10 minutes in a toddler room. And then you tell me if you don't see sin. And if you're still not convinced after that, put a sucker in a little person's mouth and take it out and see what happens. Okay? You know, we don't teach our kids to, you know, hey, little Johnny, come here. Let me teach you how to bite and draw blood. We don't teach our, you know, we don't teach our kids to fight. I mean, we come into this world little sinners, you know. Thank you, Adam and Eve. We really appreciate that. You who are in the witness protection plan in heaven. Now, it says in verse 29, and I want to read this to you in the Young's Little Translation, and immediately was the fountain of her blood dried up, and she knew in the body that she had been healed of the plague. How did she know? The Greek word here is gnosko, and it means to know by experience. Women, I think that you would know if you had this condition, 4,380 days of it, and then all of a sudden it stopped, you would know inside yourself that that stopped. She didn't just know of it, she had experiential knowledge of it. And it, I love this translation. It says that she's been healed of her plague, right? So she's been hemorrhaging for at least 4,380 days, and at once, because it says immediately, and at once it dried up. Anybody seen the movie Braveheart? Remember at the end where he's like, freedom! And he like goes on for like 10 minutes. I mean, that's what I picture her doing here. You know, the plague's gone. I can feel it. I know it. I mean, she's experiencing great joy from this. This is a complete permanent cure here. And now she wants nothing more than to just simply slip away with her miracle unnoticed. But Jesus messes up her plan in verse 30. And Jesus immediately knowing in himself, meaning that this is not something that's visible to the crowd. So immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him. And what did Jesus do? He stopped. He turned around in the crowd and he said, who touched my clothes? But his disciples said to him, you see the multitude thronging you and you say, who touched me? I mean, can't you just hear the irritation in their voice? I mean, put yourself there. The disciples were like, Jesus, what are you talking about? Look at all these people. I mean, 1,500 people have touched you in the last 30 seconds and you say, who touched me? Jesus knows who touched him. He didn't ask who touched me because he was confused. We're going to see that in the next verse. He asked that question for the woman's benefit. He wanted her to come forward. See, she's coming secretly, but he wanted to meet her need publicly. So you have to understand, the disciples don't understand the difference between casual contact with Jesus and reaching out to him in faith. Because the disciples are like, Jesus, everyone is touching you. He's like, no, everyone is thronging me. Only one person reached out and touched me. Jesus knows the difference between being thronged and being touched in faith. See, there's a huge difference, gang, just from bumping into Jesus into reaching out and touching him in faith. I mean, we've got, what, 5 services every week? I mean, you come to church every week and just bump into Jesus. I know that because I did that for many, many years. Ask my wife. I got saved at 17. Something happened. The pastor made a stupid decision. I didn't know at that time. I wasn't grounded enough in my faith to know that you don't follow a man, you follow God. And so I kind of, in my heart, just kind of walked away. And she was just lucky to even get me to church. I mean, I was bumping into Jesus every week. And Jesus is wanting to have an encounter with me. He wanted to have our relationship to grow. But I was like, sorry, Jesus, I got other priorities right now. I got other things I'm focused on right now. So we can bump into Jesus every week. You come to church every week and bump into him. But there's a big difference between reaching out and touching him in faith. Amen? Now, think about, I mean, who's standing there still? Jairus is still standing here, right? And he's like, imagine what he's going through, what he's thinking about. Tick-tock goes the clock, Jesus. I mean, I came and told you like, hey, this is an urgent request here. My daughter, my only little girl is at death's door. And you're stopping and, you know, you're asking the question, who touched you? I mean, what is he thinking about at this point? And in verse 32, it says, and he looked around. The Greek renders that he kept on looking for her, to see her who had done this thing. How did he know it was a her? I have a tip for you. Probably nobody's ever told you this before, but he's God. He knows everything. So there's your free tip for the day. Jesus stopped dead in his tracks and he looked around to see her, meaning he kept on looking for her. What does that tell us? That Jesus is seeking to find her, isn't he? I love in Luke chapter 19, verse 10, it says, the Son of Man, Jesus, that's his title, that's his favorite title of himself, the Son of Man has come to seek and save that which was lost. Meaning you and I, we come into this world sinners, like we talked about. And in verse 33, it says, but the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. So a lot of you have to look at what these words mean. Fearing and trembling, it can have 2 meanings. It could be fear, real fear, or it could be like an awe or a reverence. Here it means actual fear. It means she had a fear when she came before him fearing and trembling. Why? Because remember, she's ceremonial unclean. Okay, so she would have came to him very privately, right? That's why she came, because they could have stoned her, they could have killed her for the way that she was coming to him, okay? You know, she might have expected Jesus to lash out to her for touching him because of her touch would have actually made him ceremonial unclean until showdown or till sundown, right? Now, notice what Jesus doesn't do here. He doesn't quote the law to her, okay? Apparently, you haven't read the book of Leviticus. Let me educate you on what it says, you unclean woman, right? He doesn't do that. She didn't need to fear him. Jesus wasn't interested in humiliating her in front of this crowd. He wasn't, he didn't want to preach a sermon to her about the law. He just wanted to help her with her problem. That's what he wanted. And so she fell down before him and told him the whole truth. Can you imagine what that looked like? You know, her story. 12 years ago, this started, and I thought it was going to stop, and it kept on. And I just believed any day it would stop, but 12 years, it kept coming. I tried everything. Nothing worked. I was so tired. I was so worn out every single day. This disease beating me day by day. And I went to all of the doctors of the day, that doctor and this doctor, and spent all the money that I had. And I didn't get better. My condition only got worse. And because of that, everyone around me abandoned me. And I didn't ask for this. I didn't sign up for this. I didn't want this. And I was all alone until someone told me about you, Jesus, and I started to hope again. And look at how he, after she tells him the whole truth, look at how he responds to her in verse 34. And he said to her, daughter. Can you hear his tone? It's very tender and very loving. Not condemning, not based on the law, very loving, very tender. He speaks to her not as a man to a woman, but as a father to a child. And it's the only time in Scripture where we see Jesus call someone daughter. You have to remember, contrast that with how society viewed her. She's an outcast. But to Jesus, she's family. And it says, your faith, so your belief in what you've heard about me and what I'm able to do has made you well. Well there means whole. It's a bigger word than just being healed. We can be healed of, you know, a sickness or a disease, but that doesn't make us whole. So it's a bigger word than just being healed. It means to save, keep safe and sound, to rescue from danger or destruction. That's what it means. We throw that word around so loosely sometimes, I think. To be saved. I'm saved. That so-and-so got saved. And it's almost like it maybe has very little meaning behind it to us. But I want you to remember the next time, if you're not in a religion with Jesus, but you're in a relationship with him, he saved you. Well, what did he do? He keeps you safe and sound. He rescued you from danger or destruction. So maybe we might, in light of that, we might appreciate it a little bit more because it cost him everything. Amen? Now, remember, was it Jesus touching, was it when she touched Jesus' clothes that she was healed, or was it her faith that healed her? It was her faith that healed her faith in Jesus. We can put our faith in a lot of things, you know. You're putting your faith when you get home, when you get in your car, and you drive to wherever you're going to go after this service, that you're going to make it home. We put our faith in a lot of stuff, right? But when you put your faith in Jesus, it's a faith that is hopeful. It's hopeful. You don't know if you're going to make it home today. I'm not trying to scare anybody. Don't send me an email. But you can put your faith in Jesus, and that's a faith that always pays dividends. And he says, go in peace. What that means is go into peace. We know that Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and it says, and be healed. It's that word whole. It means be saved of your affliction, of your plague. So it's like Jesus is saying, daughter, this meeting hasn't just been about your disease, your plague, or your suffering. Yeah, that's what brought us together. That's what drew you to me, but it was for your salvation that I stopped dead in my tracks. It was for your deliverance that I searched for you in the crowd. Not just to heal you. I could have touched you and healed you and could have easily let you slip away quietly. But then you would have slipped right into hell. And because I love you, I don't want that. Now, Jairus needed to see this miracle take place. Because remember, he's like, tick-tock goes the clock here. I mean, what are we stopping here for? My daughter's on death's door. He had to see this miracle because he's about to get the worst news that a daddy can get in the next verse. Verse 35. While he, Jesus, was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, and they're speaking to Jairus, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? Kenneth Weiss says it this way. Your daughter died. So here's what they said to him. Your daughter died. Why are you still bothering the teacher? I mean, could we sign him up for some tech classes or, you know, some people skills? I mean, there is, you know, wow, how hard, you know? And it says, Jairus, you know, I just think of Jairus here. I mean, his heart would have probably sank into his shoes when he heard this news. I mean, he must have thought, man, when we're standing there and Jesus is having this encounter with this woman, I know this was taking too long. I mean, this woman has been this way for 12 years. I mean, surely she could have waited one more day. But my little girl is at death's door, you know, and she couldn't wait, you know. There's a delay there, right? And so, just crazy. I mean, my heart would have sunk to the ground there, you know. And maybe he's thinking, you know, I should have been there for her. Instead of going to talk to Jesus, I should have been there when she died. I didn't even get to say goodbye. And in verse 36, it says, as soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not be afraid, only believe. You need to understand the Greek tense here. Both of those things that Jesus said are commandments. Are commandments optional in the Bible? No, they're not. Here's what the Greek tense means. It says, hey, I know the news that you just got is bad, okay? But here's what I need you to do. I need you to stop being afraid, and I need you to keep believing. That's what the Greek tense renders here. Stop being afraid, keep believing. Because Jairus had faith. We've already seen it. But he has a shaken faith by this bad news. It's a lapse of faith. I mean, every one of us, if we're honest with ourselves, has had a lapse of faith, okay? And if you feel bad about that, even the disciples had a lapse of faith. When Jesus is, you know, taken in the Garden of Gethsemane, what do all those guys do? Do they hang by Jesus' side? What do? They run away. What about Peter? A little girl comes up to him and says, hey, you're one of Jesus' followers, aren't you? And like little sissy boy before this girl. He's not strong. Every one of us have had a lapse of faith. Every one of us has, if you're honest with yourself. Okay, so he says, stop being afraid, keep believing. So Jesus tells Jairus he has to do two things. First, he must stop being afraid. Now, maybe that sounds cruel to you in light of his little girl just died. Maybe that sounds cruel to you. But Jesus knows something that we all need to grasp. We all need to hang on to. Faith and fear cannot exist at the same time. They can't. Not in your heart, not in your mind. They can't. You have to pick one. And it's your choice. You can pick that. We know that because of what Jesus said. Stop being afraid. He knows that he's afraid. He knows that the news that he just got is really, really, really bad. But stop being afraid. Keep believing. And then the second thing that Jesus told Jairus was only to believe. Don't try to believe and be afraid at the same time. Don't try to believe and figure it out intellectually. Okay? Don't try to believe and make sense of this delay that's happened. Instead, only believe. That's it. That's all I want you to do. Okay? Remember, this is presently happening. This is like real time for Jairus. He just got this bad news. See, at the beginning, we read all of the 21 through 43, didn't we? We know the end of the story. We know what's going to happen, but he doesn't. He hasn't read verse 41 and 42. He doesn't know the final outcome. Otherwise, Jairus would have said like, hey, you think what happened to that woman is cool? Wait till you see what Jesus does in my house. You think that was awesome? Wait till you see this. But he doesn't know that, does he? He doesn't know the end of the story, just like we don't when we're going through trials. We don't know the end of the story. We're not always promised that our loved ones will make it, are we? That they will be healed. We know that they can be saved, but they won't always be healed. Sometimes God chooses to take people onto heaven, doesn't he? My dad died at 50. He's not here. He didn't get healed, but I know where he's at. Oftentimes, we don't know what the outcome will be, and that's why we're called to walk by faith and not by sight. This is earth. It's not heaven. We have disease. I've come to hate that word, cancer. We have cancer. We live in a fallen world. The Bible tells us that sin entered and death followed. Thank you, Adam and Eve. Once again, I'm going to beat you up when we get to heaven. I'm just kidding. That wouldn't be loving. And it says, now, what was it that Jairus was supposed to believe? The only thing he had to believe was the word of Jesus. He's supposed to take Jesus at his word. Everything told Jairus that this situation was hopeless, but the word of God told him that hope was just around the corner. And hope, I love this. This is what biblical hope means. It means the earnest, sincere expectation of something coming good. I love that. And in verse 37, it said, and he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Now, I don't know why these particular three get the extra time and the extra missions with Jesus. We just seem to see in the scriptures that they get the extra time, they get the extra missions. I mean, maybe because they're like Larry, Curly, and Moe, and Jesus got to keep an extra eye on them. I don't know. I don't know why that is, but apparently, you know, Jesus needs to spend more time with them. And so in verse 38, it says, then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult. It means big noise. And those who wept and wailed loudly. In this day and this time, it was customary when somebody died to hire a professional mourner or mourners because it would add to the atmosphere of grief and pain at the death. So they're, picture this, they're like weeping and wailing loudly. This sort of literally drove me crazy. I would have wanted to throw a brick at him or something. This sort of absolutely driven me crazy. And then here's what Jesus does. When he came into Jairus' house, he said to them, to the professional mourners, why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping. Okay, so here's what Jesus meant by that. He's not saying that, he's not denying that the daughter's death actually occurred, okay? She actually physically died here. She's not unconscious, she's dead. But Jesus can speak about death as though it was sleep. So when he says the child is not dead but sleeping, he meant that she was not dead just to stay dead, because he's about to resurrect her, okay? For Jesus, here's how easy it is for Jesus to raise the dead. It's like shaking you and waking you up saying, hey, wake up, sweetheart, like we would do with our kids. Hey, it's time to get ready for school. You know, parents, you remember doing that. That's how easy it is for Jesus to resurrect somebody, because he has power. He's been given power to do that. And in verse 40, it says, and they ridiculed him. They mocked Jesus, is what that means. But when he had put them all outside, you know what that means? It means he kicked their butts to the curb. He got them out of there. It means by force. I pictured it like Jesus. Remember, you know, you learn about Jesus in children's ministry, meek and mild little Jesus, right? And then, you know, you read about this account where he makes this whip, cord of whip, and he starts whipping these guys because they're making his father's house a den of thieves. Because if you guys remember the account, these money changers, these guys are selling these animals for the sacrifice, and they're selling it at double the cost inside the temple rather than outside the temple, and they're the same animal. And they're double charging the people that are buying them inside the temple, and Jesus is not happy about that. So he like makes this cord of whip, he drives them out of there, and he's turning over tables. And he says, for this reason, you know, this is a house of prayer, and you guys have turned it into a den of thieves. So just kind of, I get that picture of Jesus like driving these mockers out of there, right? Because this is probably going to affect the faith of this mom and this dad. And then it says, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him, Peter, James, and John, and entered with the child was lying. This is probably hard. The parents are entering this little girl's death chamber, right? They haven't read verse 41 and 42. They don't know what's going to happen. So there, and it gives the idea of they're walking down a long corridor, like it's a long walk. And, you know, that'd be a hard situation for any parent to deal with. And then he says, then he took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha kumai, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, arise. So this is Aramaic, the language. It's Aramaic. We know that Jesus spoke Greek. He spoke Hebrew, but he also spoke Aramaic. And a better translation of this, when you dig a little bit deeper, it means little lamb, arise. I find that really cool, because one lamb is speaking to another lamb. You have the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world that is speaking to this 12-year-old little girl. One only son speaking to one only daughter. That's a pretty cool scene. I wish I could be there. And then it says, so immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement. You think? I mean, if you'd have been there, would you? Right? So think about the things that visited the house of Jairus that day. Great sorrow in the beginning of the day, but followed by great joy and peace. In fact, the Prince of Peace visited the house of Jairus that day. I can just see the parents' tears falling down their face from a hopeless situation to a hopeful situation. Now, side note here, is we have three resurrections in the ministry of Jesus. We have one in Capernaum, which is, this is Jairus' little girl. We have one in Nain, which is the widow's son. And we have one in Bethany, which is Lazarus. It's really cool to me that in all three cases, you have an only daughter, you have an only son, and an only brother that was resurrected. So the only daughter is the one that happened in Capernaum. The only son is the widow's son. And then the only brother is Lazarus. And I find that cool, because God the Father understands losing an only one better than anyone. John 3:16 and 17 says, you guys know it, you probably, one of the first scriptures you ever memorized, but for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever shall believe in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. So that's so cool to me that God the Father understands losing an only one better than anyone. Now, notice that Jesus didn't fail Jairus, and he didn't fail the woman who needed the healing. But in helping them both, he increased the faith of Jairus. Because Jairus needed that delay, didn't he? In order for his faith got tested. And it got shaken. But he knew, based on what he saw, that Jesus was able to do something. And then in verse 43, it said, but he commanded them strictly that no one should know it and said that something should be given her to eat. I love this because the great physician has a great bedside manner. Why don't you give her something to eat? I know she's hungry. And it says the little girl could walk and eat, showing us that she was not only alive, but she's well, just like the woman. So I started out this morning by saying Jairus's name in Hebrew, it means whom Jehovah enlightens. And enlighten means to give intellectual or spiritual light to instruct, to impart knowledge to. Do you guys think that God did that for him? So I entitled this morning's message, Faith That Strengthens Others. I can take a lot of things from this chapter. I think it's a great lesson in coming to Jesus in desperation, to believe in the power of Jesus's touch beyond the human limit. I mean, both Jairus and the certain woman came to Jesus in desperation and they fell before him and they asked for their help in desperate situation. But I think the main thing we need to walk away with, or at least I'm hoping that you do, is that you're going to go through difficult situations in life. Like I said, this is earth, it's not heaven. We have all these things, we have trials, we have all types of things that go on. And people need to see your faith when you go through difficult situations, don't they? To maybe help them increase theirs. Just like Jairus' faith will increase by how he saw Jesus interact with the woman that had the issue, the plague, for 12 years. You have a multitude around you, watching you. And especially if they know you're a believer, they're watching what you do and what you say. And they're examining you. They're, you know, around you. They're looking. I promise you that they are. And they need to see when you go through hard times that they need to see your faith in Jesus. Because it will ultimately either save them one day, either have them come to a faith that they don't currently have, or build the faith that they currently do. So I'll end with three things. Hebrews chapter 11, 6, this is how God views faith. This is how important faith is. It says, but without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And in Ephesians chapter 2, here's what it tells us. You read verses 1 through 10, but I want to highlight a couple of things just for the sake of time. It tells us that we are dead in our trespasses and sins. But God, and because he's rich in mercy, made us alive in Christ. And then finally, in Acts chapter 17, verse 28, that Jesus Christ is the giver and the sustainer of life. It says, for in him we live and move and have our being. Amen.